From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we go behind the scenes of the Netflix interactive feature Bandersnatch, which is up for the Outstanding TV Movie Emmy. And the new film Hustlers is set during the Great Recession. Director Laureen Scafaria says its main location, a strip club, speaks volumes about that moment.
The rules of the club just felt like the rules of the world to me. It felt like the trickle-down of both of those things seeps into every other part of our culture, every headline, I think. And I feel for everybody who's trying to navigate that broken value system, the women and the men.
All that coming up on The Frame. Earlier this week, I sat down with writer and director Laureen Scafaria right after her movie Hustlers arrived in theaters. The Jennifer Lopez film opened to great reviews and strong ticket sales of $33 million. The film is adapted from a New York Magazine article about a group of strippers who fleece men out of hundreds of thousands of dollars, spiking their drinks and then running up massive charges on their credit cards. Scafaria wrote and directed the film with inspiration from a familiar genre.
We thought of it as a sports movie like anything else, certainly that part of the story where they're in the club and that locker room and that feeling of walking out from the locker room out onto the floor. In the script, it was written like football players leaving the tunnel. It's safety in numbers. It is a team sport. It can be a solo sport, obviously. But we just wanted to highlight the athleticism of it, the strength, the power that it takes, certainly in shooting a scene like Jennifer's big dance number, Ramona's entrance. That was something that we knew we wanted to shoot like a boxing match, kind of. And so we wanted to give her that entrance, like a fighter entering the ring. So much of where the camera goes is aligned with our theme of control. And so it's attached to our camera work as well. And so a scene like that, Ramona's in charge of where the camera goes and when we cut.
Well, let's talk about where the camera goes, because the camera goes in these kinds of movies in a very specific place. And it's a camera that is operated and directed by a man. Mm. And the way it looks at women's bodies is very different from the way that you shoot this film. What were the things that you weren't going to do that are almost the staples of this kind of movie?
You know, I didn't have to think too much about it because honestly, it was all about POV. It was all about walking in their shoes. We wanted to still make a sexy scene because that's what Ramona wants. And it is a bit of a hustle. She's hustling us, the audience, just like she's hustling the men. She's certainly playing and toying with the male gaze the way that we are, because even though we're seeing the movie, I think, in a way that other striptease movies haven't really seen them, it still felt like there's no shame in this. You know, I didn't think we needed to hide from that either, because I think we're showing the power that she's wielding with her body. And so there's a power dynamic there that we were able to shoot women in this epic way, in this larger than life way. And also how we lit them. I mean, there's like low angles, which are often reserved for women under 25 or men. And so it was all a part of being able to tell this very epic story, this intimate story, see women who do this for a living from the neck up and understand their motivations from the neck up and the neck down. And so humanizing this industry was also a really important part of it for me, was to tell a human story that happens to be about strippers, that happens to be about women who do this for a living.
And at the heart of the human story is a friendship. And the women who work together work with each other and for each other. And I want to play a clip with Ramona, who's played by Jennifer Lopez, explains why they have to think differently.
We got to start thinking like these Wall Street guys. You see what they did to this country? They stole from everybody. Hardworking people lost everything. And not one of these douchebags went to jail. Not one. Is that fair? You ever think about when they come into the club? That's stolen money. That's what's paying for their jobs. The firefighters' retirement fund.
And that's getting at kind of a bigger idea that women in this world and women in the larger world are defined by their bodies and their sex appeal. And men are defined by their money and their power.
Yes.
And that seems to be almost the micro and the macro story that you're looking into.
That was the thing I was most interested in talking about, was this broken value system that I think we're all navigating. And yes, women are valued for their beauty, their bodies, whether that's for sex or motherhood, and men are valued most for their money, success, power. So the rules of the club just felt like the rules of the world to me. It felt like the trickle down of both of those things seeps into every other part of our culture, every headline, I think. And I feel for everybody who's trying to navigate that broken value system, the women and the men. The cards are stacked against certain groups of people. I describe it as being out of breath at the starting line. But is it any wonder that the financial crisis happened when that's our value system, when greed is rewarded, when men are told that that's their greatest contribution in every pop song and movie and in real life? I do feel for the men who can't afford to take a woman on a date. And I also obviously feel for the women who are told that this is their greatest value. But I don't judge any job or any gender, since those are the top boxes we're meant to tick. It's a little insidious, obviously.
It is more than a little insidious. The magazine story has the headline, "Here's a Modern Robin Hood Story," which I think is not accurate.
No.
They're not Robin Hood. They're not stealing from the rich to give to the poor. They're stealing from the rich to give to themselves. And they're consuming some of the very things that the men that they're stealing from are consuming.
Yes.
And it feels like you didn't want to excuse what these women did.
For me, you know, crime is crime and greed is greed. And so I think there's a moment when survival turns to greed for them. I think it is a lot about survival. It is about raising their kids and mouths to feed and having dependents and not having a lot of help. And so I think it's important to look at where they started from as much as where they ended up, obviously. But yeah, I mean, it's American culture. It is wild. And at least the lead up to the crash, I remember how much, I mean, we were peaking culturally, certainly, and in excess and material things and brands and labels. And we've kind of bounced back to that place, too, in a way. And now we're kind of just debating which corporations do we like best. And so it's a brave new world, obviously.
Coming up next on The Frame, more of my conversation with Laureen Scafaria, the writer and director of Hustlers. She tells me about how she used music to tell the film story. Let's get back to my conversation with writer-director Laureen Scafaria about her new movie, Hustlers. It's ultimately a story about powerful women trying to get ahead and breaking the law along the way. The story of that power is told in part through music, such as in this scene where Ramona, who's played by Jennifer Lopez, teaches Destiny, played by Constance Wu, a few dance moves on a pole.
Front hook.
Ankle hook.
Yep. Knee hook. Hold on with that knee.
Okay.
From here, you can do the carousel.
Put your head back.
Come down.
You can do Peter Pan.
Knee hook.
Just spin.
Jesus Christ.
Not typical strip club music. I think that's Chopin, is that
right?
That
is Chopin, yes, yeah.
And that there's a lot of Chopin in this film. And there's obviously some pop music. Mm. There's some Janet Jackson. There's some Lorde. The music almost makes this scene and what these women do feel like ballet, that they are no different, really, than ballerinas or corps de ballet, that they're dancing and that's how they make their living.
I was excited to show this scene in which the character is doing obviously similar dances to the previous scene where she's on stage herself, but show the difference of it and show the ballet of it. The pieces are the Chopin etudes. They're the studies, so they're kind of the hardest stuff to play on piano. When I was writing the script, I had written all of these Chopin cues into it because they felt like the sound of the dancers, the sound of what it takes to do that pole work, which is so grueling. I mean, it's Jennifer Lopez, who's in better shape than any human person, needed to train like crazy to be able to do those moves. She was so bruised from it. And to show the grace and also that that friendship there, this new dynamic between Ramona and Destiny. The music ended up becoming the sound of the story, the sound of Destiny and Ramona's relationship, the sound of Destiny's world unraveling sometimes. Yeah, those cues, along with about 80% of the songs, were written into the script, so we got incredibly lucky with the rights to those songs.
Well, Chopin's lawyers are probably not
busy.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what was hard, though, finding someone who could play those pieces, because even the greatest pianists in the world cannot.
Who'd you find?
The man, Thomas Lyre, who he had done these recordings that I had been editing to for years. So we tracked him down finally. He was in Germany. He was very hard to find, even in the digital age. So thank goodness.
Let's talk about some of the more modern songs that you use in this film. And each song really contributes telling the story. How do you place these songs, and what do you hope they convey narratively beyond what they add to the soundtrack?
For me, it's a little bit of a musical, because each song does so much storytelling and felt so crucial to the sequence or the scene. Something like Lord's song, Royals, I was told to just forget about it, because she had never given the rights to license any of your music before. So that was one of those I just couldn't let go of.
I've never seen a diamond in the flesh.
We shot the sequence to it. We timed it out that way. I played that song for Jennifer before she walked up the street, so she had the rhythm in her head. And then I wrote a letter, an impassioned letter, Dear Lord. and then we sent her the sequence. So I guess she liked it, because she gave us the rights to it.
But every song's like gold teeth, gray goose dripping in the bathroom, bloodstains, ball gowns, trash in the hotel room, we don't care.
But something like the Fiona Apple song, which is a favorite of mine, obviously, I didn't have that in mind, actually, because the script said Ramona does one final flourish and then steps off stage. She had a song in mind that the tempo was a little slow, but I knew what she was going for. So I said, well, what about Fiona Apple's Criminal? And she was like, oh, yeah, I've been a bad, bad girl. I like it.
We're talking with Laureen Scafaria about her new movie, Hustlers. I want to tell you about something that happened to me when I watched the movie in a public theater, because I found it really distressing. There's a scene in the movie where a woman who has done something that she's not proud of is paid what she thinks is $300. And it turns out she's paid not three $100 bills, but three $20 bills. And when she realizes that, there were a couple of men in the theater who laughed. And it was so upsetting for me to watch the movie and have that reaction. And it took me out of the movie for a second, but then it put me right back into it, because it got me thinking about what this movie is trying to say about the way that men value or don't value women, and the way they do and do not value what women do in the workplace, and the opportunities that women have presented to them.
Well, it's funny, that moment, I mean, when I've watched it with an audience, there's been audible gasps and most of the audience is horrified. And then you pause for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, and you see guys whispering to each other. I overheard, that's a good idea, or we got to try that. Is it any wonder that this story feels like long overdue in so many ways? Not just, I think, that how people devalue women, certainly how they devalue strippers and sex workers. And that was part of why I felt like I know these girls. I can relate to these girls. We have a collective experience. We're all having a collective experience that in navigating this broken value system. We just are. And yet these women are judged so much. There's such a stigma around what they do for a living. And so I feel like a real responsibility to the community to talk about it.
But that power dynamic is not limited to strip clubs.
No.
It happens in law firms. It happens in business. It happens in Hollywood. And yet a movie like Hustlers that does really well is still the outlier. At what point does a movie like this not become the exception, but the rule, that you can have a movie written and directed by a woman that stars women, about women, and people don't say it's a fluke?
I don't know. I mean, we had a good weekend I think money talks. That's the unfortunate theme of the movie as well. Is that money, you know, rules the world still, which is part of why I was interested in seeing women earning it and women providing for their families, because we're often seen spending and shopping in movies, but not often seen earning and providing. And there were questions, early drafts of the script, are, you know, are they good enough moms? And I just thought, wow, I mean, not only is it not that kind of a story, but everything these women are doing is in theory for their children and for, you know, for their kids to have better lives than they had. And I think that's incredibly relatable. We've all been offered the American dream in some way. We've all been told if we just work hard enough, we can make it. And I think we've seen that systems are not in place to help people succeed, obviously, and certainly not in places to help marginalized people succeed. So even though this is a crime drama, ultimately, even though, yes, these women did bad things and we know what those bad things are and we know where they cross the line, I couldn't help but want to hold a mirror up to all of it, all of us who are all participating in this in one way or another.
I want to ask you about casting. The USC Annenberg Inclusion Initiative has studied the top 1,200 grossing films over the last 12 years, from 2007 to 2018. Two lead roles went to a Latina actress over age 45. I suspect you know who that is.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
That's it. And that's it.
Yeah.
So when you're thinking about casting, and not just Jennifer Lopez, but people like Lizzo, people like Constance Wu, people who have different body shapes, different ages, different ethnicities, how intentional were you about making sure that even if the part wasn't written for a specific person, that you made sure that you were casting, so to speak, a wide net?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you cast a wide net, it's not that hard to find just really talented people of all kinds. And so that certainly was part of it, was just casting the wide net. But I very specifically thought these people were ultimately just right for the roles. And I wrote some of the parts for some people, like Lizzo and Cardi and Trace Lissette and Meta Tauli. I wrote a lot of the roles for these specific women, and I'm so proud of what the cast ultimately became, because it does really feel like, you know, we get to speak to a lot of different female experiences. And I know for some of the strippers that I spoke to, they at different times have been Destiny and at different times have been Ramona. And so it's nice to see that people are able to step into the shoes of different kinds of women also, and feel seen by a woman that doesn't necessarily even represent them demographically. That's actually a very beautiful thing.
Laureen Scafaria's new film is called Hustlers. It's out now in theaters. Laureen, great to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next on The Frame, we get a primer on the complicated math behind the multiple storylines for the Emmy-nominated Bandersnatch. Bandersnatch is a choose-your-own-adventure movie from the creators of Black Mirror. It's nominated for Outstanding Television Movie at Sunday's Primetime Emmy Ceremony. In the Netflix production, a game designer follows the choices that viewers make through the streaming service's interactive platform. The result can be a down-the-rabbit-hole odyssey as the main character tries to finish his video game, aptly titled Bandersnatch. And as The Frame's producer Robert Garova learned, the movie's complex adventure, with its overlapping timelines and branching narratives, also mirrored the making of Bandersnatch.
My name is Russell McLean. I was the producer on Bandersnatch.
My name is Marilyn Kirby, and I was the script supervisor on Bandersnatch.
Marilyn was the first person we approached who kind of signed on to this project, I think.
This was a beast of a script. I remember thinking, right, and kind of being in a bit of shock and thinking, can I do this? Will it be good? Will I be okay? And yeah, I think I was confused as to how I was going to do it, but kind of excited at the same time.
We started with a flowchart with a very rough outline, and then quick realised that the flowchart wasn't going to be up to the task, and so we started working in this software called Twine that people use for writing games and things like that.
Yes, it was almost, and Russell can tell me off for this, I'm going to say almost like a PowerPoint presentation as far as I was concerned. So you would just, you know, you play it on software on Twine, and you could click, you know, to make your choices, and then it would take you to a different screen, and then you'd have a bit of text explaining what this was with your next choices on. My job had other elements to it, because I also had to play Bandersnatch, as it were, through the Twine to see that the story works from a continuity point of view. You know, thinking, if you make this choice, does it still make sense from everything else that you've got?
The next game under our Christmas spotlight is Bandersnatch, in which the player navigates a shifting timeline of parallel realities based on the book of the same name by Jerome F. Davis.
Our actors were great, really, and so we just had to, we'd always have the twine to be able to kind of show them, easier than the script would do, where this particular scene had come from and where we were going to. You know, there's some scenes like in The Office at Tuckersoft, you know, three versions of Stefan first coming into Tuckersoft, theoretically. And so then you'd be like, do you remember this is the third time around?
I'm Colin, yeah?
Yeah, I've played all of your games. All of them, except the Commodore ones. I don't have a Commodore.
No. You know, this is the second time around, so you already know this bit.
We've met before.
No.
And so, but they were, I do think they were pretty good at kind of knowing where they were.
The actors were all brilliant. But it was the scene that Marilyn's describing when Stefan meets Colin for the first time, that was actually the first day of the shoot.
And
so we sort of picked the, in a way it was the trickiest thing. Not just for the actors, for the kind of costume, makeup, for David Slade, the director, it became... Actually, each day they were focusing on the pages of script that were shooting that day, and Marilyn became the person that knew the context of everything. So it was always like kind of everyone was always shouting to Marilyn, kind of, where are we? What happens next? Where does this go to? I was expecting to have to reshoot some stuff because there's bound to be mistakes or kind of issues, and we'd allowed a couple of days of reshoot. And then there was no continuity errors. There was nothing that we'd missed. We were maybe 3-4 weeks after the shoot that the production coordinator was still trying to figure out whether we'd actually shot everything, which we had. Interactive stories have been done before, but this is the first time, I think, that it's been done at this scale and be able to reach this kind of audience, and people are able to watch it on their regular TV. As a piece of art, it sort of depends on what choices you make, and I think as an interactive thing, you've got to embrace the fact that not everyone's going to choose what you want them to choose. And so I always thought, because you've got one person with a controller controlling the choices, it would be quite an individual experience. But we've found out since that actually people enjoyed playing it with family and friends, and people were having Bandersnatch nights and arguing over what choices people were making. So it actually became more of a kind of a group viewing experience than I ever thought it would.
People think there's one reality, but there's loads of them all snaking off like roots, and what we do on one path affects what happens on other paths. Time is a construct. People think you can't go back and change things, but you can. That's what flashbacks are. They're invitations to go back and make different choices. When you make a decision...
I'd also say that I think, as a piece of art, it works, because I think the story is of a man trying to code, essentially, an impossible story and being driven mad and about the choices that he's trying to make. My friends say they kept trying to save Stefan, and in the end it's like, you can't save him.
Yeah.
In the same way, in the story, you know, he can't save himself, you know. And so I think, as a piece of art, it stands up just about the idea that, are there any real choices?
Last weekend, Bandersnatch won a Creative Arts Emmy for Outstanding Achievement in Interactive Media. Also last weekend, among the dozens of trophies handed out, the Emmy for Outstanding Original Music and Lyrics went to this.
fluoxetine, fluoxetine,
paroxetine, paroxetine,
citalopram, citalopram,
take once a day. Fluoxetine, fluoxetine, paroxetine, paroxetine, citalopram, citalopram.
That song is titled Antidepressants Are So Not a Big Deal. It's from the final season of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Crazy or not crazy, you be the judge. Anyway, congratulations to the songwriters Adam Schlesinger, Jack Dolgen, and series star Rachel Bloom. And speaking of the Emmys, tune in for our annual preview of the Primetime Awards. You can hear it on KPCC Friday at 7, Saturday at 2, and Sunday at noon. And that's it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.